This is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. This is Art Radio, WPS1. You're listening to www.wps1, a PS1 Contemporary Art Center radio program, a MoMA affiliate. You might also be listening at www.frankprattle.com. Today, it is my special pleasure to present to you the art duo, Lovid, Tally Hinkes and Kyle Lapidus, as well as Thomas Beard, one of the founders and directors of Light Industry here in Brooklyn, New York. We're in the basement of Q Foundation, where Lovid is has an artist residency here in Chelsea in New York. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Maybe you can start out, Lovid, on my left here, just talking a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do.
Hi.
we work with signal and memory are the two kind of basic components of what we do. We make signals. We started out making them purely electrical signals and have recently become interested in biological signals and environmental signals.
And we use sort of technically a whole variety of tools and media. We usually start with video. And the video that we do is generated by our own homemade synthesizers that produce both audio and video. We've been doing those since 2005. And they're also very sculptural. So they're both have a functionality and technology aspect, as well as aesthetics and conceptual. And from that video, then the signal, as Kyle was saying, that the instruments produce, we then create a whole wide range of objects, as well as video recordings and web projects sometimes as well. We do a lot of prints and fabric and collages of objects, and recently here at Q, also some paintings and installations and some live video objects that incorporate sculpture components as well as other tactile.
And for those listening along on the internet, do you guys have a website that they can go to?
Yeah, lovid.org is our website, and from there you can link various other projects.
L-O-V-I-D.org.
Yep. Okay.
And Thomas, maybe tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do.
Well, I run Light Industry, which is a new venue for film and electronic art with Ed Halter. And it just began a few months ago. I guess more or less our first season has wrapped up, and it's basically a series of weekly events, screenings, performances, lectures that, at least in its kind of first incarnations, are organized by a different artist, critic, or curator every week. So, and then also I write for different publications and have other kind of curatorial projects at different venues around the city and elsewhere.
Okay, and maybe a website for people to tune into?
Oh, sure, lightindustry.org.
Now, you guys are no strangers to each other. It's no secret that you all happen to be sitting around the same table today. Tell us a little bit about how you got to know each other. You know, was it an early collaboration with something?
Yeah, I think I used to run a series for artists film and video called Ocularis, which was in Williamsburg, and I contacted Kyle and Tally just because I wanted to organize some kind of event with Lovid. And eventually what we decided on was an evening that they curated called Flip Chips, that the premise of which was basically looking at two different generations of artists who custom build their own hardware video instruments. So, you have a sort of early generation of artists like Nam June Paik, Steina and Woody Vasilka, Dan Sandin, Matthew Schlanger, Bill Etra. Then, on the other hand, you also had sort of more contemporary artists like Lovid, but also Paperette and Corey Archangel, Paul Slocum, Carl Klomp, Billy Royes. I'm forgetting some folks. But the premise was a very interesting one because, on the one hand, if you look at some of the Vasilka's work, or you look at Paul Slocum's work, let's say. Artists who were working, beginning in the early 70s, and artists who are, whose practices are just kind of beginning, over past few years. On the one hand, there are many sort of like formal and conceptual affinities, right? Like there are a lot of sort of striking similarities. Yet at the same time, I think that what that show really brought out was that while there is like very much a kind of continuum between those two bodies of works, like the perspectives that the artists were coming from were very different, right? That like in for this first generation, they're in a very literal way experimenting with new technology, you know, and there's a lot wrapped up in that. I mean, there's a kind of utopian scheming, you know, that was very much kind of like a part of early video politically, again, also it's about sort of trying to really sort of like push the boundaries of what, you know, of what this material, this new technology can do. But you know, for Queer Archangel and Paper Rad, you know, they're also, for instance, say, like, dealing with their own custom-made kind of hardware video equipment. There's, you know, there's sort of like 30 odd years of sort of technological development and sort of like cultural history sort of wrapped up in, you know, what's at stake in their kind of making this work. And so, you know, it means something very different for, you know, I don't know, Steve Beck or something to, you know, do sort of video weavings in the early 70s than for someone now to like hack an 8-bit, you know, Nintendo cartridge that they might have played when they were sort of a kid. So I was, you know, that was basically probably the first substantial kind of project that we worked on together, and I, it was a really wonderful experience for me, and it definitely led me to want to work with them more.
Sounds good. And yourselves, you know, when Thomas approached you, what was he thinking on him?
Well, it was I think it was like in 2006 maybe or something like that, I would say. And it was a great time for us because we have sort of finished our first instrument around that time or a little bit before that. And, you know, starting to show our work more, more and more, and getting more, responses. And we, and a lot of what we do is, and sort of become almost a part of our practice, is do a lot of talks and sort of artist lectures in universities and different places. And we quickly realized that there's always this sort of question about the technology that you're using, especially when you work with what's, you know, qualified as sometimes new media, no matter how old your media is. But, there's like, to talk about tools. And a lot of the time, the question we would get at the time was, well, why are you doing something analog, right? Because our systems are analog now when, you know, there's all this, you know, similar technologies have been done, 30 years ago. And we sort of decided to, kind of address those questions, right up front, and really to put this program together as a way to contextualize what we do and really discuss exactly what, Thomas was saying, our choices of making it other artists of our generation and why, why we do what we do. And it was actually a great experience. Partly because of that program, but also previously when we were developing our tools, we get to meet some of the older generation of artists, which has been really amazing, and really, talk with them and get their perspective.
And it was also a good chance to talk to some of the, the contemporary people who are doing this, who maybe we had been in touch with once. Some of them we're friends with, but some of them we hadn't, or we had only barely talked to on email. It was a good chance to kind of follow up with them, and then, and then to see some more of their work and be able to present it. And that's been really exciting for us, just in terms of thinking about what we're doing, and also in just bringing it to new places. So we, since that screening at Ocularis, we've shown it a few more times. We brought it to Chicago. And we also showed it here again at Art in General.
Yeah, so really putting that together has really it pushed us so conceptually to work in different places, because Thomas was mentioning a little bit about the old generation of artists sort of trying to see where technology can go. And one of the things that we always talk about is that the work that we do is not to pursue of some kind of technological invention. No one who's hacking their little thing at home is thinking about that. We really are using tools, for personal expression, or, to, figure things out in a completely different way. We think a lot about fragility and, where the systems can't handle anymore. Carlos talked about signal and memory. That's kind of the things we're thinking about. We're not thinking about what's the, you know, sort of the cutting edge of technology. And that also kind of reflects on our work with, you know, other media, like digital media, like, you know, the internet.
Well, that has broader implications too, I think, that film and video, like, or film and electronic art, or artists working with film and electronic art are in a sort of unique position because the tools that they're working with in many cases also exist in a kind of like popular or commercial realm, right? And so, you know, for Kyle and Tally, it might be like working with like analog video equipment, but I think that what they're doing like has, you know, is not that far afield from, you know, I mean, formally it's very different from say like artists like working with, you know, small gauge film, right? Like Super 8 or, you know, 16 millimeter film, or, you know, even like taking it even further back, like, you know, I don't know, magic lantern slides or something, right? That these, there are these things that have, you know, are, you know, obsolescent, you know, in a sort of a, you know, sort of a, in the realm of sort of, you know, as sort of consumer products, right? But there's still like this, you know, kind of vast aesthetic potential like within them. I think that just because like, you know, you know, that there are, you know, yeah, exactly. That like there, that even though like, you know, no one like uses like shoots on Super 8 for, you know, their home movies now, doesn't mean that like there isn't, you know, still like a lot to sort of like be, a lot of work to be done, I guess. You know, but I mean, obviously, like if you're a painter or something, like that's not a kind of issue that you kind of come up against, right? Like why are you using, you know, why are you using this kind of paint, or why are you
acrylic? No,
yeah, exactly. With these kind of materials, like this idea of, because there is this idea of, you know, it's moving towards something, right? And I think that can also have, you know, sort of an effect on the, like, the work. Like it also, even though that's a kind of like, kind of a consumer idea of like having to like move forward and other things obsolescing, I think that in a weird way, culturally, that can even filter into, you know, the like people who are like looking at contemporary art. Like that, you know, it seems preposterous for someone to say like, why are you, you know, like to ask Lovid well, didn't the Visulkas like work with this kind of equipment like 30 years ago? Like there's this idea for people who are working with film and electronic art that there has to be like, you know, like the avant-garde has to keep advancing somehow. Like it has to, whereas like, you know, again, it's a question that no one would ever ask a painter, right? That like, this isn't like, you know, it's like abstract painting. Like, you know, it's like I've seen. I mean, there's this, I don't know, there's some line that I feel like I always like come back to, that Peggy Alwish, I think, wrote once, like quoting Napoleon, that the purpose of the avant-garde is not to advance but to maneuver. And, you know, I don't know, I think that really sort of summed it up, or sums it up for me on some level.
So one question that I have that relates, you know, very, very distinctly to that is the idea that, you know, today in the age of, you know, the iPhone and YouTube being omnipresent everywhere you go. I mean, you know, even presidential debates now are on this magic mystery pixel machine, you know, across the nation. My grandmother had a cell phone, you know, and I never thought I'd live to see that. And as a nation and as the world becomes more and more attuned to technological advances and things like that, and it just becomes commonplace, one of the things that I sense, and you know, feel free to jump in here, is that, you know, things get cleaner and cleaner. That, you know, the Apple aesthetic is taken over, and it's, you know, sleek as sleek can be. There's no protrusion anywhere. It's all like hyper, you know, linear and brushed stainless steel. And, you know, there's maybe some heat sensors on it for your finger, and there's that horrible gesture that you see everybody doing, the wand-waving finger. But taking that and then flipping it on its head and really marrying it with an idea of homemade, of you know, of weaving, as, you know, you guys have here on the wall, of a very, very physical and craft-oriented aesthetic. That's one thing that I find totally fascinating about your guys' practice. Maybe you guys can talk a little bit about
that. Yeah, that's definitely one of the kind of other directions that we like to explore with this, is sort of what you were saying about how technology has become so streamlined, and, you know, that's sort of part of the linear, quote, progress of technology, but that there are really these other ways where the wires could break out and go everywhere. We call that, we talk about wireful, and things that are just the wires that kind of expand out, and they're really clear and you see and can touch the electronics and really feel it as a real thing rather than some closed box that you can't get inside of and just whatever it's doing it does and you interact with it in a prescribed way.
Yeah, I mean, it's this whole thing sort of gives you this illusion of perfection. You know, Thomas has mentioned the word utopia. It's exactly it. It's this, you know, everything is perfect. It's very controlled, you know, and this is how it's presented to, like, you know, the math population. But, you know, I think one of the reasons where, you know, us and other people of generation are into this hacking is that we sort of see sort of the guts and the insides of machines, and you know the reality of how, you know, how things don't always work. And it's not, you know, it's organic. Every, you know, it's like there's glitches, you know, this whole sort of fascination of glitch art. That's like, you know, another kind of phenomena that I think is a part of this generation. And, you know, we see it in a different, you know, in a different way, you know, kind of trying to bring out all those, you know, the fragilities, the places where things are not controlled and, you know, and perfect and kind of hidden and discreet. So, yeah, kind of, sorry, yeah, I was going to say something.
Oh, no, sorry. I was going to say, you know, that you bring up glitches.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you guys can talk a little bit about what each of your favorite glitch has been in, you know, recent technology or in, you know, technology over time, like one of your favorite Fritz moments.
Oh, man.
Glitch.
Glitch.
Well, I mean, I like some of the web projects that have been done with it. Like, I can think of, like, Mark Napier as one of, like, some of his kind of shredding where he would take different things. That's sort of a glitch. But I think a lot of what I like about glitches is kind of when they just happen. So I had one before, actually. You mentioned YouTube,
and
I was listening, trying to listen to a song for the girls, for our daughters. We have two daughters, who maybe you can hear in the background. I was trying to get this song up for them that we had just heard on the radio coming down here. And I'm not sure exactly if it was the connection or what it was, but it just started to kind of catch on one little bit of it, which probably, you know, that sound that it makes, the kind of buzzing of it, just trying to play the same little.
It's the lock, you know, the lock over the skipping records, you know, it's like those. It's like that stuff, you know, and that's what's so amazing. It's an expressive thing. It's life where it's like you're trying to control the time, just like, you know, flipping out, you know, it's like the shit happens, you know, and that, like, that's what we really are excited about for us. That's like that place where you can still experience it. Because those things, I'm sure, happen all the time, but we don't have, you know, our senses are maybe not acute enough to perceive them. That's sort of one way of looking at it. But when you kind of can perceive them, it's this, like, in your face, you know, it's this very energetic thing. And you're like, oh my God, it's like the electricity itself right now is, you know, is communicating, you know, uncontrollably. We couldn't control it, you know. Nothing that man made could have, like, you know, made it behave. It's like not behaving.
Right.
Like,
That's sort of how the universe is also. I mean, it's kind of, you know, stochastic is a term you use to describe it, but it's things just kind of happen, and you can't always exactly say how it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's just a very interesting place, right? Just when things start breaking down, right? Because
exactly.
It just sort of, like, opens up a window for all manner of sort of, you know, new possibilities.
Now tell me, you know, as we're kind of, you know, talking about this intersection of I would say kind of fact and where that plays into fiction a little bit as well, is like, you know, creating new narratives and things like that. How big of fans are each of you of science fiction? I mean,
I guess I'm a pretty big I'm sort of a big sci-fi fan. My partner Ed, who runs Light and History, would probably, like, cringe for me to say that, because he's sort of like the true nerd, right? Like, he totally, like, he, like, subscribed to Analog when he was a kid. And, you know, like, he was like, I mean, you know, so you know, and whereas I, like, you know, he jokes that, like, the only, like, sci-fi books that I read would be, like, on, like, sci-fi books that would be, like, on, like, a women's studies syllabus or something. Like, you know, like Ursula Le Guin or, like, Octavia Butler. Things that are sort of, like, safely, sort of, like, or, like, Samuel Delaney. Like, things that are these, like, safe, like, kind of safely literary sci-fi. Like, So I guess, yes, I am, like, a fan of sci-fi. But, like, I definitely don't have the sort of, like, nerd cred that my boyfriend does, as do many others. Maybe these guys, I don't know.
I probably don't have the cred either, but I definitely love science fiction. And yeah, that's probably in terms of fiction that I read, that would probably be my first choice of what I usually read for science, for fiction.
One of the things I see for American culture, and please, you know, jump in once again, is the kind of the co-opting of not only science fiction, but more towards comic books and things like that by Hollywood of large movies, mm-hmm. you know, all the way from, you know, recently X-Men came out. I think they're putting out another Batman, if I'm not mistaken, like 28 or whatever they're on now. And what do you see as far as creating your own narratives and, you know, highlighting those narratives in a cultural context that you guys are bringing forward? Do you know what I mean?
I have to say, if we're talking about sci-fi, there's also sign and how that relates. And I think kind of like our sort of fiction really, it's probably more closer to science than it is to, I would say, science fiction. It's kind of very highly inspired by it. I'm not sure. But because I'm thinking that for me, and I'm not necessarily reading science fiction books, but when we started working on some projects a few years ago that were very inspired by physics. And I started really listening and actually watching some sort of popular science shows, like particularly, I think it's called Horizon, like a BBC show, which is really, you know, kind of amazing. And it really does, you know, it talks about time traveling and all those things, but, you know, from the mouths of, you know, scientists. And so it's very close, you know, it's very, very close, but it talks about, you know, sort of, you know, real facts and numbers and, you know, and yeah.
I would say that in terms of the science fiction that I like, I really do like sort of hard science fiction.
Yeah. Cool.
So, I mean, that's definitely true, but I think in terms of sort of our narrative, one of the things we talk about a lot is retro-futuristic. So that's sort of where we get into the sort of fictionalized narrative.
Yeah, but I mean, the things that we really are thinking about is this idea of time, you know, and how time is an element, and we think a lot about physics, and we kind of, I mean, for me, I'm not a scientist. Carl, you know, is also a scientist, so he understands it in a completely different way than I do, and I think I create these sort of narratives. But more in like maybe like a formal and abstract narrative rather than, you know, a full story. We do think a lot about this idea of, you know, a parallel world, you know, and sort of this, you know, time traveling and time being, you know, this like a flow and like, you know, having patterns. But, you know, this is again something that you can hear, you know, we have some friends who are scientists and, you know, cosmologists, and they talk, you know, talk about things that you think are just, you know, they're like the most abstract, insane things, you know, that they're saying. It's like theory. It's really fascinating. And for us, you know, we can talk about what's interesting is that I was mentioning that briefly, that you know, sort of patterns and systems in, you know, the universe are organized in similar ways in a very microscopic level and in, you know, a gigantic level, and you can find them, you know, and you know, in all sorts of areas in the world, between, you know, people and communication and, you know, and then, you know, planets, so.
Well, and I think also that, in a way, like, if Leavitt's work is sci-fi, I think that, you know, science fiction and, like, Leavitt's work both, like, have, sort of at the front of them, like, this, you know, a sort of fantasy of technology, right? Like, and, I think that's something that's kind of always been a part of video art on some level. I mean, like some of the most famous, I mean, you know, like Max Almy's Leaving the 20th Century or Joan Jonas's Double Lunar Dogs, like it's always, you know, it's always been there on some level. And it just, maybe it's just kind of like manifested itself in different ways at sort of at different points. You know, I think that was certainly the question, like in the sort of late 60s and early 70s of like, where will this take us, right? Like where will video go? And but I think that it's still like a pretty you know, a pretty sort of like relevant idea. But now I think people are just looking backwards and forwards, you know, not just sort of to the future, but also to like the sort of the history of, you know, fantasies of the future, if that makes any sense.
Definitely. One of the things, you know, to tie into that a bit is one of my favorite artists, you know, from older artists is Stellar, and his work with kind of that zombie cyborg, as he you know, as he would describe it. And as I see your work, Leavitt, your work coming together is is really a participatory, you know, moments as well. Like, you know, the instrument to our right, just to briefly describe it for those listening, is a table maybe 10 feet long that has, my guess would be, close to 100 wires and multicolors sticking out of it, and pink tacos wired into it with, you know, I would say maybe 1,000 or more wires beneath the board as well. So it's just a giant jumble of outputs. It looks akin, I would say, to, you've seen the old Hollywood films where there's a lady with a beehive and she's the telephone operator and she's got a million holes before and about 2 million, you know, cords coming out, and she's operating at about a million miles an hour. That's what it looks like, that in a blender. And so you have something like this, and, you know, whereas many older, you know, kind of, say, digital interface or intersection pieces, you know, it was just the artist doing their, you know, mad scientist, you know, routine in front of everyone else, showing them the kind of the edge of technology that they're pushing. You guys are really bringing more of a, like I said, participatory aspect to it, where you invite Thomas, you were part of one performance.
Yeah.
And you invite other people, you know, the audience, to really bend the technology with them. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's actually the piece that you're mentioning with Thomas was a performance called that was called Video Fingerprints, and we premiered that at MoMA last month, and we've done a sort of another version of it in Hudson as part of 3103.9's summer concert series. Slink Moss invited us up there to do. But it's funny that you mentioned another one of those interventions, the wireful interventions, which are all, by the way, supported by LMCC, we should thank. But another one of those interventions relates to the kind of telephone operator thing that you were mentioning, where we're doing conversations at a mile. So this will be outdoors in Riverside Park later on this summer, and people will be invited to have a conversation across a physical mile of wire. So they'll be on either side, you know, separated by a mile, and they'll be talking to each other. And, you know, now it's not very sort of impressive to have, this is sort of going back to the other thing, now you can have a conversation hundreds, thousands, you can have a conversation anywhere in the world on your cell phone, it doesn't matter, but the connections are very kind of abstracted, and it's sort of this almost kind of magical thing that you have this phone and it does this thing. I mean, you know that there's some kind of technology somewhere behind it and that there's some kind of waves going and somehow sending your signal to them. But it's all become, in the same way that the elements of the interface are all hidden, also the elements of the actual communication have also been hidden. So this is, you know, also trying to open that up, where it's very clear there's this mile of wire that's connecting you physically that's also carrying your conversation. And I just love the idea of there being someone who's making each conversation in the world happen, that there's one person who has to plug these things.
Well, the other connection between, no pun intended, between the sort of switchboard operator, you're sort of referring to the image of the switchboard operator, and Luvit is patching, right? Because that seems like patching is like really sort of like central to what you guys do.
Excellent point. Yeah.
And I mean, that's a common thing that I was thinking in, like, the sci-fi and, like, you know, physics in this other world, and, you know, in the senses, you know, as we were saying, like, there are these physical connections, but we can't experience them. When you sort of reveal it with, like, putting something really kind of, you know, raw and crude and, you know, just like big wire, you know, all of a sudden it adds this other meaning, you know, because you brought this very physical thing. So there's other things that I was going to talk about this piece, and then, you know, again, like these kind of two generations and something that happened a long time ago, is one of the things that we realized quickly when we started meeting those, you know, this older generation of media artists, is that, you know, when they see our instrument, they're very excited. They're like, oh, you know, I used to do this analog stuff, it was great, but now everything I want to do, and I can do on a computer.
Right.
You know, and that's just like when we first realized, oh, it's like this complete, they're coming from a completely different place than we're coming from, because, you know, that for us, computer is like, you know, this controlled environment, right, where you can, you know, compose things, and, you know, we're working in this chaos, you know. And then the other thing is that before there was the internet and cell phones and all those things, artists who were interested in this you know, and interactions and creating networks, had to be extremely crafty in developing systems that were composed and created around their sort of special own vision of what that network is. You know, they were like orchestrated both technologically and, you know, it was like a whole other craft, you know, that now is missing because, you know, everything is laid out there for us. You know, we have it all. It's all there. So, you know, what do you do with it? You know, it's kind of, and we're, I mean, for us, creating the system is a part of it. You know, it's kind of like, oh, this is, you know, kind of represents the way we're thinking about it. And sometimes it's kind of funny because, you know, we might have, you know, someone like Thomas or other people participate. And actually, Zephyr, you yourself were recently in a performance where we had invited a lot of people to use a network. And, you know, so you experience the other side where we're creating a system that makes sense to us. And then you have to translate it to other people. And how, and that experience of actually sharing it with other people. I was talking to a friend recently who was also at one of the performances, has this really interesting mode of confusion. And that confusion is maybe very related to that glitch that we were talking about before, you know, and I think that's something that's exciting for us to work with in terms of participatory experiences.
Well, you know, as far as simply a bystander, you know, or somebody who, you know, also engaged with one of your performances, I have to say it's a hell of a lot more fun as well, you know, than simply going to watch somebody on stage who, you know, does their thing, and then their thing is over, and, you know, whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, it, you know, generally leaves a fairly small impression on you. What are your feelings about, you know, kind of hosting participatory events, things where, you know, you actually have the audience involved?
Well, I think that, for instance, like at Light Industry, not all of the events are explicitly, you know, participatory, right? Like, you know, at MoMA, like I was, you know, holding the, you know, actually was like holding the, you know, the 3/4-inch cable and, you know, participating in a you know, very sort of explicit way. But I think that actually the whole idea behind Light Industry in many respects was thinking about what it means in, you know, 2008 for thinking about the cinema right now as a kind of social space, right? Is very distinct from, you know, gallery going or other kind of ways of other ways of kind of experiencing art. And I think that in many instances like that, I think that there's something still very important, you know, about you know, being in a room with, you know, 50 other people for, you know, sort of 2 hours and, you know, sort of sitting down or not sitting down and, you know, sort of, you know, seeing these like lights kind of flicker in front of you. I mean, the work itself might, you know, may have kind of like evolved, you know, substantially from, you know, over the past, you know, sort of several decades. And so like what, you know, like the words, you know, cinema right now, it's like very kind of like loaded and complicated, and it's like, you know, so if we have like this young experimental like game designer installing like a bunch of like weird video games at Light Industry in a few weeks, like, is that cinema? Like, I mean, I think so, but it's just not necessarily the first thing that would come to mind. Or Lovit, for instance, like, you see, I mean, like these like incredible like visceral like image processing performances, like, on the one hand, like, yeah, it's cinema, but like, if I, you know, when I say that word cinema, it's not necessarily like, oh, you know, the first thing that might like pop into someone's head. So and I think that even if, you know, by, and so I guess those are a really long-winded way of saying, I think that by going to these, you know, those sorts of, going into that kind of sort of social space, right, is itself kind of participatory, even if you're not holding a wire, right? Like you're being part of something, like, right. You know, it's like, I mean, it's like being part of any subculture, right? It's like going to, like, you know, it's, I think, I'd like to think, at least, that there's something, it's very sort of punk rock in that regard, right? That it's, you know, as a sort of social experiment, that's what makes it interesting. So
that kind of group experience, in that we love that. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we love to perform and to do these kind of performances, whether they be participatory or not. They're not always explicitly, you know, as Thomas was saying. But we also try and keep that element, and that sort of gets back to what Tali was saying in the beginning about kind of time and the moment. And we try and, even in our non-performance-based work, and even non-interactive work, we try and always have that element of something really happening live in that moment, and that it's an experience, even if it's not a direct experience that we're having with the audience at that moment, that they're still experiencing something that is happening in that moment. So that's where kind of all of our other work with live video, even in our objects, so we've made installations, one that kind of comes to mind because it particularly deals with time and with the universe, is something that we did at the Neuberger Museum in 2006, I think. That was called Inverted H-Barn. And it starts at the Big Bang and goes from there. So you can see that 2005, 6, 7, whatever it was. Doesn't make, it's the kind of a drop. It kind of explores the history of the universe from the kind of early, very first moments of it to sort of the current state of it. And it develops through the space. And in that, there's live video that's being produced. The modules are built in to the installation. It's a large installation that you can walk inside of, actually, and you can peek up towards the beginning of time and see the video that's up there that it generates. And what we're doing here at Q is sort of a similar thing where we're making these objects. They're live video objects, so they're smaller than that, and they kind of hang on a wall, but they include all the electronics, and they make the video live. So they're not an instrument that you go and play, but they are, at that time, making what you're seeing.
One of the questions I have, and this definitely goes for all you guys, is when you're making something that is that tends to be a live performance, that tends to be something that is in the moment, that is shown specifically under certain conditions to elicit some sort of response from the audience, whatever that response may be. How do you then represent that later, when the moment is not going on? You know what I mean? Like, for instance, looking at your website, Lovid, like, there's a certain wall that the viewer sees because they weren't there to plug in, the various apparatus and, to hold the cord, things like that. How do you guys tackle that? And similarly, when showing movies and things like that, and how do you present those at Blind Industry as well? Those boundaries for you guys.
It's a really good question, and it's sort of something that I think we constantly are thinking about and dealing with in every little thing that we do. For one thing, I think we have sort of like an attraction, and I've noticed that recently, actually an installation by Lucky Dragon that was at the part of the Whitney Biennial. It was a room where he had done a performance, and it was sort of like a reminiscence of a performance. There was like the instrument unplugged, and the wires lying around, and you had a feeling of this, that there was something that happened there. And for me, that's a very intense, almost a spiritual experience, because that thing that we were just talking about, I've been thinking a lot about this. It's a specific attention. A lot of people are in a room, very focused on something. And that thing sort of echoes in the room once everyone's left. That's sort of my narrative, if you want, or experience of it. So for us, that trace of that memory, that time that was, imprinted in that, visible or invisible space and objects, is sort of stays there. So for us, it might stay there in an object, in an installation, that there was a presence, something had happened, and now, the people are gone, but it's still there, it's captured. It might be in a video recording, something. And again, people might experience it in a completely different way, but it's okay, because there are many different levels of experiencing it. I just wanted to say one thing, because it's kind of something to that. I've been working on some paintings in the studio here, and it's been really interesting. I'm not, I haven't been painting in 10 years, but I've been kind of trying to do it every summer, and it's been really interesting because I'm starting with, a tiny little piece of a collage, and the collage that I'm using is basically a video recording made from a performance or a recording session, then printed on paper, then recollaged digitally and printed again, and then there's this whole layers and history of it, and then I end up with something really small, and I end up painting it, and so I'm realizing, what we're talking about, all this memory, all this information that this has gathered, I am now just, interpreting into something else. So, that's my...
I think we think a lot about that, about how something that's live exists when it's not that moment. And that's part of what I was saying with the live video objects and the, live video installations. But also in our single channel work, we try not to do any post-processing. So we make efforts to keep it as much like the live experience as possible. But then, as you mentioned, there are these sort of group experiences, especially for the participatory stuff, where there's not exactly a clear way to replicate that experience when it isn't there. And so, I mean, one of the things that we've kind of done to deal with that is to think very clearly about what kind of documentation we present. So that's sort of, I guess, part of how we got to the Venus mapped score that we made. You know, in the performance, there's a live video score, and then we make live video. Or the score is not live. The score, there's a video score that's pre-recorded, and we make live video according to that score. And so, but to present that, you could show kind of a recording of it, of the live video with the score that's already recorded as a two-channel piece, but it didn't really make sense to us. So the way we dealt with that was we made it into this sort of a printed publication. So it's a completely different kind of material and a different experience, but we think that maybe in some ways that kind of will capture some of the elements of it in a different way. And obviously it's not the same as being there, but it's something different that you don't get from being there. Similarly with the Wirefall performances, the Wirefall interactions, the interventions that we're doing this summer, we're doing a publication for that with Analogous, where it's gonna be a little book with a cassette. And they have an interesting distribution method that they use for that we'll be building into the final presentation of that.
And I was also really, I'm really excited that the score for Venus Mapped, the performance that Kyle was just referring to, is going to be part of this collection that I'm editing, all about sort of of a kind of contemporary reader about live cinema. I think that it's interesting that, you know, live cinema or sort of intersections of performance, film, and electronic art is something that is also generational in a way, that you have this really sort of like interesting body of work from the sort of like mid-60s to the sort of like mid-70s more or less, and then also like over the past kind of like 10 years. You know, on the one hand, cinema has always been live, even sort of before its own existence. You know, magic lantern slides, phantasmagorias, camera obscuras. You know, all these things actually like predate the sort of cinema proper as we know it today. And then in the, you know, in the mid '60s, you have you have all these artists working with what was often referred to as expanded cinema. And then more recently, over the past 10 years, you know, you have like all kinds of artists, like, I mean, Loewe, but also artists like Sandra Gibson and Louis Recoder or Bruce McClure, who do these really sort of like elaborate multi-projector performances with 16mm or other small gauge film equipment, or, you know, an artist like Gwen Greenwood with her project Tracing the Plastics, you know, who would do a lot with like live musical performance with sort of like interactive video projection, and many others. But I think that one of the things that was, like what you were saying, really sort of central to the project of putting this book together was about how to deal with this work that by its very design is totally ephemeral, right? I mean, in a way, that's also part of its kind of power, or, you know, it's kind of a, you know, it's a sort of weight as art, is that it's fleeting by its nature, right? Like you're there and then it's over. Yet as Talia was saying, like there are these traces, right? There are, you know, these sort of like residual elements that still exist. So in addition to like a series of like essays or interviews with artists in the book, there's also like a lot of ephemera, like the score, but also, you know, like the you know, posters for movies with live soundtracks, which was this project that Xander Morrow sort of oversaw in Providence, basically from like what, the mid '90s to the sort of like earlier aughts or sort of thereabouts. Through like, and she also made these like really sort of like elaborate sort of silkscreen posters for them. I think actually Loewe was part of that like many years back. So there's actually a sort of subtle connection there. So you know, like again, like so there's no like you know, there's the, like in the book, the only trace of movies with live soundtrack is like are these sort of posters, you know. So like you can't, on the one hand, like you can't get a, you know, you don't get a sense of the actual experience of the performance, yet the sort of like milieu in which these things took place, which was sort of like Providence at that time, and for instance, like the really like lively sort of like poster art scene that was happening and is still happening there today, like is very much kind of in evidence. So, you know, it's a challenge, but I think that it's interesting to sort of like collect these materials together and sort of see what we, you know, can kind of make of them. And I think that, as Talia was saying with the piece at the Whitney, like this sort of the traces of the performance can have their own sort of weight.
Definitely, you know, the ghost energy, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. The spectral evidence.
One thing that I'm always interested in is kind of, I would say, the fuck up, if you will, and the mistake. And maybe you guys could talk a little bit. I mean, definitely, you know, your area of expertise tends to be, you know, breaking things open and then, you know, kind of gluing them back together in different formations. And, you know, Thomas, one of, you know, your areas of expertise is recombining things, you know, for people to view in a new way. So tell me what some of your greatest screw-ups were and what some of your failures you think were.
Well, if we talk about mistakes, you have to sort of be honest a little bit and reveal a little secret that, you know, there's two of us in Lovid.
Right, right.
And we are very complementary, but we also are very different in the way we particularly relate to the idea of mistakes.
I'm the really uptight one.
I'm the messer-upper. So that's, you know, for us, it's a really, it's a really interesting way to work, which I think is why we, you know, we work well together, is there's a sort of a plan. And then there's the actual process of making it. Kyle tends to sort of want to, his sort of intuitive way of working, wanting to work, is make a plan and then just follow it through, just execute it as planned. And I like to sort of know all about it and forget it completely and then start from the wrong place and end up somewhere. And, you know, that's how we would work if we weren't working together. But as a collaborative, we sort of managed to kind of meet in the middle and make different compromises along the way. And I don't know if I have, well, I mean, okay, I do have the worst mistake story, the not the gefilte fish, the other one of those ones.
wait, what is this?
When we first started making like sculptural electronic things, the objects.
Our first actual audio video synthesizer was all integrated into one. Gefilte fish.
Oh yeah.
It was called the fish, but we were working on it with Douglas Repetto actually, and who we work with a lot to this day. But that was one of our early collaborations with him. And we'd built this instrument, but it was kind of not quite finished. And that was actually for another event, a festival that they were having in Providence, called Sonic Transmutation, and that was dealing with all people who were also building equipment, mostly for music, building electronics and performing on them at this thing. There was also an exhibition as part of it. But we had just finished, we were trying to finish this, you know, audio-video synthesizer. We had made some video-only synthesizers before that, and we were really rushing to finish that in time for it. It was probably 2004, I guess. And somehow it all broke the night before, of course.
Well, it was like it's a really tricky thing when you're doing something, you know, like something that needs to be functional, but also you want to work on the aesthetic. And then we didn't know quite yet what goes first. You know, what do you do first? Do you first make the system to make it work, and then you build the thing around it? The idea for these objects was that they were these pillow encased, you know, electronic devices. Actually,
they were sort
we have
of
one
synthesizers that you could hug and love. Yeah, the Bitmap show.
Oh.
That Vertex List curated and showed there in the spring, and then now it's in Philadelphia.
So there's this fabric, you know, soft things, that this idea that, you know, we were talking before about how, you know, cell phones and computers are hard and plastic, and we wanted something cuddly and colorful, and there's a built-in speaker, or like the knobs, so the gefilte fish, we had to, Kyle made electronics for us, and then I just stuck the electronics in like pillow stuffing, which is completely insane, with no like protection, and it was just like wires.
It was like fiberglass pillows or whatever.
Fiberglass. Yeah. And we ended up like
And it was somehow, we didn't have time to put the outside together with the inside, God. So we had to play it from sticking our hands inside the fish. That's why I was thinking filter fish.
So have you guys, I mean, obviously the question, you know, the big fear is that, you know, electronics catch on fire. Have you guys had any fires?
Oh, yeah. What? So we had a great experience with that. We played in, we were getting ready to tour in Europe. And we scheduled a talk in South Jersey, the day before we were going to Europe. And we were building, so we had, you know, the table that you were talking about before, the synharmonica, that's a big instrument. So we couldn't bring it. It breaks down, it's very modular, and it fits in the back of our car, and we can go on tour in America with it. But bringing it on the airplane wasn't going to happen to Europe. So we made these wearable ones. And of course, that was also really last minute, and we had them, and they were kind of working. And we talked at the school there, and then we were playing a show in some basement that night there, and it was very smoky there, and we were pretty exhausted because we've been working on them. And for some reason, Tali didn't want to go in. She wouldn't go in. I think it was too smoky, and she was pregnant actually at the time with Lisa, and she didn't want to go in. And so I was like, well, we have to do this show. I'm going to go, and I'm going to play both of them. So there are two rehearsal songs. Normally, we both play. We both wear them. And so I put them both on. And of course, they're made to fit one of, you know, you can wear one of them, but two is kind of, it's like wearing two shirts or something. Not on top of each other, but next to each other. So it was a little hard to manage. And I guess I had messing up, kind of trying to add a little piece while we're at the school and whatever. And I go in there and they just totally start smoking. Of course, everyone's really excited. I'm like, oh, no! So that was definitely a moment of that.
Well, it's funny, Matt, because the moment I was thinking of is not... well, it also involves something burning, basically, which is that... actually, it was not very long ago, like a few weeks ago at Light Industry, this filmmaker, Jennifer Reeves, was showing some of her films, and one of them was this thing that she'd never showed that she made when she was really young, like a Super 8 diary film of going to Cuba. And one of the things that I guess I've often thought about recently at Light Industry is that like Super 8, finding a good working Super 8 projector is like, I don't know, like a unicorn in the forest. Like it's just like, it's like an impossible task. And yet she like brought her own that had been like working, you know, but like that she was, you know, she had been using a lot, and so it's like, okay, phew, you know, we have a good Super 8 projector, don't have to worry about that. And so she like starts it up, and literally like within the first like, you know, 30 seconds, the frames just like freeze, and then you can just see it melt.
Yes!
Like, and which is really funny is that like anyone who's in, which is it was a really funny experience, because anyone who's like has ever gets to see film burn live, it's like this incredibly beautiful thing where like, the frame just really willows apart, and but of course it's like incredibly traumatic for the sort of filmmaker themselves, right? Like there's, I think this was like a super, it was like the original print, and like those frames are, you know, sort of, you know,
gone
sort of
forever.
Like gone forever. But it's, I mean, it was also in a way, so, you know, sort of like at once like beautiful and terrifying for me as like a curator and her as as an artist. Yeah, it's funny because the film was actually itself was about like her kind of like, she was like, you know, this like young, you know, like sort of like, you know, she, I think she actually narrates it as like a, you know, sort of like a, you know, like vegan bisexual sort of like leftist going to sort of like Cuba with other sort of like a, some like socialist, American socialist group, and then just being basically having this like deeply sort of like conflicted and disenchanting experience of like, you know, sort of like, you know, sort of being young and having a certain kind of like still like political consciousness that's still in formation, and then sort of seeing the reality of a sort of like leftist project like, you know, Cuba's kind of gone awry, and so it was sort of like weirdly fitting that like, you know, we sort of set out to have this really nice Super 8 projection, and then it sort of didn't exactly work out like that. And then, but in a way, like running a space like Light Industry or any, you know, any space of its kind is that it's, you know, it's very raw, and I mean that's the challenge as like someone who's running the space, but also one of the pleasures, right? Like I think actually for our first show too, we didn't realize that because it's in this giant like 6 million square foot industrial complex, that there are these giant floodlights that come on like right as the sun goes down, so which we hadn't anticipated. And like for our first show, like we'd spent the entire day seeing that, like, you know, preparing for every possible sort of like element, and then like, you know, the sun goes down and, you know, it's dark in the space, and then whoomph, you know, these like floodlights come on. I was just like totally, and it was like, and the show was starting like 10 minutes and I was just like, you know, like freaking out. But then I think afterwards,
and
I
you
remember,
got your slingshot now.
Exactly. But then my this video artist Cecilia Doherty was that their first show came up to me, and afterwards, and I was, you know, just totally like apoplectic. Even though everyone else seemed to have like a really good time, that she was just like, if you want a regular, she's like if you want a perfect show, go to a regular movie. And I was like, oh, that's a nice way of looking at it. But yeah, I mean, that's you know. That's, yeah, so again, that's part of the, that element of failure is sort of like always lurking. But that's also kind of part of the, you know, part of the fun, right? That like things break down and you never know what's going to happen.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to leave it. Thank you guys so very much. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle here at WPS1 Art Radio, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, and MoMA affiliate. You're listening at www.wps1.org or at frankprattle.com. Today my guests have been the fantastic art duo Lovid, who is Tally Hinkes and Kyle Lapidus, as well as Thomas Beard, the co-founder and co-director of Light Industry in Brooklyn. Maybe you guys could just give your websites as we go out here.
www.lovid.org
and lightindustry.org.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.